This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to look at the way in which Cold War American liberal intellectuals thought about the world. It's kind of easy to talk about McCarthyism, about how the American kind of nativist xenophobic right within the Republican Party thought about things. That's well documented. What's kind of slightly harder to pinpoint is this actually kind of prevailing ideology for much of the Cold War, from really the Truman years through to Kennedy, and you really see it starting to kind of peter out under Nixon, of the Cold War liberal intellectual. Now, I suppose one of the difficulties with exploring this is that liberal is a term that has now become so mangled, again, by the kind of by right wing, largely American discourse. It kind of appears in Britain from time to time, but it hasn't got that deeper roots as it does in the US. This idea that liberal means anything from the progressive centre left all the way through to kind of Marxist-Leninism. I mean, obviously, if you listen to kind of, and I hope none of you do, but if you listen to things like the right discourse on Fox News, they always kind of talk about the kind of liberalism as if it's some sort of kind of criminal offence. Well, there's a kind of a different way to conceive of liberalism. Now, if we're looking at David Coates' brilliant book, The Great Fear, which is a fantastic history not just of the kind of McCarthyite era, but also of America during the early Cold War. David Coates writes in his section titled The Ideology of Cold War Liberal Intellectuals. He writes about the cultural critic Lionel Trilling. And he says, writing in 1946, Lionel Trilling offered a plausible description of liberalism that had prevailed, particularly amongst the educated classes during the New Deal era. A ready, if mild, suspiciousness of the profit motive, a belief in progress, science, social legislation, planning, and international cooperation, perhaps especially where Russia is in the question. So there was a tendency within the liberalism of the 1930s, really kind of Rooseveltian liberalism, if you will, to look at Russia with an open mind at the very least. But the way in which Lionel Trilling describes liberalism there is a kind of managerialism, an idea that perhaps market forces aren't necessarily the way to run things. However, they are also, you know, quite useful if harnessed correctly. And that science and technology and progress and a certain kind of scientific rationalism would really reshape society when we get away from all these sorts of irrational creeds like faith in the free market. However, liberalism under the conditions of the Cold War shifts decisively to the right, and David Cope writes, "The onset of the Cold War shattered this liberal consensus. The pro-Truman Americans for Democratic Action was founded in January 1947, within a week of the rival left-wing Progressive Citizens of America, a schism, a polarisation foreshadowing the Truman-Wallace rivalry of 1948. And just as the president won that duel by an overwhelming margin," referring to Truman's his feud with George Wallace, who was on the left of the Democrat Party, "so too, Cold War liberalism emerged head and shoulders above its competitors to the left and to the right as the dominant ideology within government, the press and the world of learning. The linchpin of this creed was hostility towards the Soviet Union and American communism. Concomitantly, that mild suspiciousness of the profit motive became very much milder. The Cold War liberals embraced the Pax Americana." The Democrat Party that existed throughout the Cold War era and into indeed the kind of the post-Cold War era of the 1990s, this is the kind of the Clintonite Party, had moved so progressively, progressively as in stage by stage, to the right. It had embraced essentially all the core assumptions, except some cultural ones, of the Republicans. And this perhaps reflected the shifting of the political landscape in America through the Cold War overall to the right, or perhaps it actually stimulated that shift. But you have the two founding principles of the Cold War Democrats were a robust and warlike a desire and capacity to fight hot wars throughout the world, partly out of the fear of being labelled weak, unpatriotic, willing to give in to communism, all these McCarthyite accusations that the Democrats during the Second World War had been far too quick to cozy up to Stalin, and it had been essentially a democratic weakness that had lost China. This was certainly a shadow that was cast over Kennedy and Johnson, neither of whom wanted to be seen to have to back down over Cuba in Kennedy's case and Vietnam in Johnson's, and that neither wanted to be seen as weak presidents who were losing the Cold War. And the other assumption that the Democrats more readily embrace as they moved in time further away from the legacy of Roosevelt was a greater kind of comfort with greater affinity to American capital. Not to suggest that there was very much left about Roosevelt at all, though he did appreciate the importance of an empowered labour force with trade unions, that is a kind of a careful management of labour. But Roosevelt himself was a classic New Deal liberal figure, as has been was kind of laid out by Trilling, one who was there to stabilise American capitalism, not to overturn it or to weaken it, but to pull it out of crisis with vigorous state intervention. Of course, that state intervention was, during the New Deal, was minuscule compared to the state intervention of the Second World War. And it's that level of state spending and control over industry that really is what transforms the US economy. David Coate writes of the Cold War liberals, "Both the achievements of the New Deal and the victory over the Axis powers reinforced their sense not merely of American power, but also of American rectitude, insisting, as they did, that Truman's foreign policy was altruistic, defensive, and reactive to the Soviet threat. They became so preoccupied with containing Russia, and later China, that they forgot all about containing America. In a bipolar universe, they desired and demanded an almost limitless extension of American power and influence around the globe because, as the ADA explained in its founding statement of principle, the interests of the United States are the interests of free men everywhere. And by 1951, the ADA was supporting limitless assistance to Chiang Kai-shek, hardly a figure of kind of liberal rectitude." So here is the place where powerful Cold War myths are created or emerge from. The idea that the New Deal, the defeat of Nazism, would naturally present America, and this is a kind of like a liberal version of American exceptionalism, the idea that America is this force for good in the world, this player of historic importance that faces down Soviet communism and is the defender of freedom everywhere, much as is kind of articulated in the Truman Doctrine. And for those that have listened to this podcast before, I've talked a lot about the kind of the domestic motivations of the Truman Doctrine and the crises created for Truman by the retreat, particularly of Great Britain as a world power and an anti-communist police force in places like Greece. So the Truman Doctrine was a kind of a moment of expediency for the Truman administration and not a kind of a deeply held creed. But there are aspects of the Truman Doctrine that we can certainly see in this new ideological position about America's role in the world. And it was the sort of thing that was being put in, being sort of propagated in the publications such as The Nation and The New Republic, in Ivy League schools and universities on the East Coast of America, where you find this kind of trifecta of liberal journalists, politicians, and intellectuals working together to reinforce a core message of America's role in the Cold War, but also kind of the more robust and militant face of liberalism. Some 20 years later, in the 1970s, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., describing himself as an unrepentant anti-communist, distinguished, or attempted to, between the obsessive and destructive anti-communist fixations of the Vietnam War era and the more rational anti-communism, graduated in mode and substance according to the character of the threat, which prevailed under Truman. So, a view that liberalism had of itself throughout the Cold War was that there was a kind of a good anti-communism, a good democrat anti-communism, that prevailed, or at least the kind of a liberal anti-communism that prevailed under Harry Truman, where anti-communism was based on kind of more on a pragmatism and a realistic understanding of the threat.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Whereas the later anti-communist wars in Southeast Asia, particularly Vietnam, which was predominantly a democrat conflict and was inherited later by Nixon, that this becomes part of, I suppose, what one could call a creed war. All objectivity in Vietnam has been thrown out of the window, and instead we have this kind of fight to the finish. This belief that, as Kennedy said, Vietnam is the place. You know, the place where we draw the line, where we fight the battle, and we have to win. There is another view of the motivations of liberals within the Democrat Party and external to it as to why they were so keen to become converts to the anti-communist cause. And that really is the successes, the political successes that the right of the Republican Party were having, both before, during, and even after the rise and fall of Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin. And the power, the political power that was accrued by a Republican Party that was really, for most of the 1940s, on the back foot, by 1946, had suddenly harnessed and weaponized anti-communism in a way that it was enormously successful, that appealed to kind of working and lower middle class America, and to a kind of a sentiment or almost of kind of like lynch mob justice that could be weaponized against the Democrat establishment, against East Coast intellectuals, against minorities if necessary, against everybody that the Republican Party saw itself in conflict with. And there is an element of kind of, if you can't beat them, join them, or at least see what votes you can hoover up by doing a sort of a slightly more genteel version, or a slightly more, if you will, liberal version of anti-communism. One that doesn't have the vulgarity, the crudity, and the implied violence of McCarthy, but is outward-looking, patriotic, and attempting to propagate the kind of the finer values, the perceived greater values of the United States of America, of freedom and liberty, the sort of the things that America was founded on, the things of the American Revolution. Robert L. Heilbronner said, "It is, I think, the fear of losing our place in the sun, of finding ourselves at bay, that motivated a great deal of anti-communism, on which so much of our foreign policy seems to be founded." David Coate writes, "Here was the impulse that prompted so many liberals to endorse military intervention in Greece on behalf of an undemocratic rightist regime, and prompted the new leader to portray Chang as the very embodiment of freedom. Here was the impulse that drew an impressive phalanx of perfectly honest writers and professors, including Daniel Bell and Sidney Hook, into the arms of the CIA by way of the American Committee for Cultural Freedom." Both Daniel Bell and Sidney Hook are really the kind of the progenitors of neoconservatism. There's an interesting number of the kind of the founding thinkers of neoconservatism who were essentially Democrats in the 1960s, but looked at the Cold War, looked at the monstrous nature of Stalinism and kind of post-Stalinist Soviet Union, looked at Vietnam and saw and believed that the stakes were so high for democracy and for liberalism, and then looked at what kind of progressive ideas in their view had generated in America during the 1960s and the counterculture, which they just found disgusting and an embarrassment. And at that point, that's where sort of liberal ideas tend to get swept away, and a more robust idea of what America should be, not a country that seemingly gives in to communism but actively wages war against it. Now, it's important to recognise that the Cold War liberals who were supportive of things like the Vietnam War, who believed that America had a mission in order to protect freedom around the world, these were not the primary supporters. In fact, they weren't supporters at all of McCarthyism. Their overseas anti-communism was not reflected in kind of domestic anti-communism, and much of that they found kind of obscene and deeply undemocratic and unconstitutional. And of course it is, because it threatens the very founding ideas that that liberalism is based on, the idea of a state that does not intrude in the lives of its citizens. And so they are kind of on the horns of a dilemma during the McCarthyite era. David Coate writes, "Although the Cold War liberals were by no means in the vanguard of their forces pressing for the domestic purge, without doubt their obsessive anti-Sovietism blinded them. We cannot take chances with the ringleaders of a conspiracy that, if successful, would pervert and destroy our institutions," commented the editor of the reporter, Max Ascoli, when the Supreme Court upheld the conviction of the Communist Party leaders under the Smith Act. For context, the Smith Act, that was passed in 1940, made it illegal for anyone to advocate the overthrow of the United States government, which is pretty much what happens on a daily basis at Communist Party meetings. Sidney Hook, who we mentioned previously, who had been passionate in the defence of liberty and believed that this was the founding principle of the Cold War, was nonetheless not entirely convinced that communists shouldn't have their liberties curtailed. The version of liberty that he conceived of was one where it becomes illiberal to allow somebody to have the freedom to threaten
the liberties of others. He said, "So long as the radio and television industries operate under commercial sponsorship, it's both unrealistic and unfair to compel sponsors whose income position is being undermined by a popular boycott of communist or fascist performers on their programmes to continue their sponsorship." Hook, unlike some of his contemporaries who, on the democratic liberal fringe, who were shocked by HUAC and the McCarthyite purges, decided in 1957 that, on reflection, the congressional committees and the House Un-American Activities Committee had done more good than harm by educating the public in the dangers presented by the Soviet Fifth Column. That is, of course, assuming that the Soviet Fifth Column existed, and it did not. David Coates writes, "Criticisms of the state of American liberties in the McCarthy era by West European writers were vigorously and hotly rejected. According to Diana Trilling, Lionel's wife, writing in August 1952, the idea that America is a terror-stricken country in the grip of hysteria is a communist-inspired idea. Hook himself claimed that the nightmarish picture often painted in the European press of McCarthy stalking up and down the country, intimidating writers, educators, newspapermen and other professional groups, suggests the vision of delirium rather than the results of sober reporting. Meanwhile, Rebecca West assured her British readers in 1953 that the investigating committees have dealt but little with college professors, and that the only terror prevailing in American academic life was among professors who dared not leave the CP, the Communist Party, for brutal reprisals. 2 years later, in February 1955, the executive director of the American Committee for Cultural Freedom, Sol Stein, applauded the McCarran Committee's harrowing pursuit of Professor Owen Lattimore and the Institute of Pacific Relations as a valuable service in furnishing the public with evaluated information concerning the work of apologists and agents of the Soviet Union who have not or cannot be proven to have broken existing laws. So there you have it. The Democrat Party and its fellow travellers and the American liberal commentariat by the late 1950s, long after the decline and fall of McCarthy, had become complacent, yeah, complicit, certainly, comfortable even, with many McCarthyite positions, for fear of their own extinction, for fear that they would be swept away in a populist anti-communist wave, in a can't beat them, so join them way, and also because their views were quite compatible with the politics of the Cold War. They were of a slightly different flavour, but ultimately the idea of waging hot wars in the Third World against communism and of curtailing civil liberties when that is important to do, when it's important to do so, became the key other face of American political discourse during the Cold War, a managerial one that was entirely happy to find common ground with the Cold Warriors of the right and institutions such as the CIA and the Rand Corporation and other American Cold War institutions. Anyway, I hope you find this useful. Do find us on Patreon. Our backers on Patreon at the moment get an additional couple of essays by myself every month. And there's some really interesting stuff I'm posting in the Explaining History podcast Facebook group. So check us out there. You can find links to everything on my website, explaininghistory.org. and I'll catch you next time. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.